Good afternoon, brethren. After the unsuccessful Ionian revolt, the emperor of Persia, Darius I, sent an army to Greece to punish the city-states that aided in the rebellion. In 492 BC, the Persians successfully defeated Thrace and Macedonia. And in their attempt, then they attempted to move southward into Greece. But doing so, the Persians lost 300 ships and 20,000 men in a massive storm. And the Persians subsequently decided to withdraw. In the fall of 490 BC, Darius sent forces back to Greece. Two armies gathered to fight on a plain in northeast Attica. 10,000 Athenians, along with 1,000 Plataeans, faced off against 15,000 Persian soldiers. The leader of the Greek forces, I should have practiced this, more often. Miltiades, there we go, employed a strategy of weakening the center of his forces and strengthening its flanks. The Persians' best troops pushed back the center of the Greek forces, but the Greeks' wings swept around the sides of the Persians and almost enveloped them. The Persian lines broke and they fled. The Persian army lost 6,400 men, but the Greeks lost only 192. The Athenians successfully defeated the Persians' first attempt to invade Greece in what would turn out to be the beginning of the Greco-Persian Wars, which lasted more than 40 years. And as significant as this victory was, the most notoriety came from what happened after the battle. According to legend, a messenger was sent to Athens to deliver the news of the victory. The messenger, named Pheidippides, ran about 25 miles from the site of the battle, delivered his message, and then died from exhaustion. Today, tons of crazy people gather in huge packs every year in cities all over the world to run races named for this famous battlefield, the marathon. Has anyone here ever run a marathon? There are two, the other one's in the back. The marathon represents the ultimate athletic effort, where the human body, mind, and soul are tested to their limits. And when you put it in those terms, I submit to you that you might be in the middle of a marathon right now. Now, no offense to all those crazy people who've done it, but the life of a disciple of Jesus Christ is the ultimate test of the human body, mind, and soul. And we are running it right now. So today, let's look at what it takes to run the Christian marathon. The first point. Number one, run like the winners. Run like the winners. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24. Now, in those packs of people who gather for all those marathons, there are runners of all skill levels. There are people running for charities. There are some who are trying to run their personal best time, perhaps with the goal of qualifying for the Boston Marathon. And some people are just trying to check run a marathon off their bucket list. And then there are those men and women who are huddled at the front of that mob of people at the start of the race. They're easy to spot because the numbers on their bibs are single digits. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it." Those people who start at the front of the pack show up with one goal in mind: win the race. Point number two, you have to prepare. You have to prepare. For our second point, we'll stay right here in 1 Corinthians 9. Now, Hal Higdon is an American author and runner. He is a contributing editor to Runner's World and the magazine's longest-lasting writer. He's also authored 34 books, or more than, including the bestseller Marathon, The Ultimate Training Guide. Hal Higdon offers more than a dozen marathon training guides for runners of all skill levels, from novice to advanced. He does have a few plans for very experienced marathoners that are only a few weeks, but most of his training plans last 18 weeks, and some are as many as 30 weeks. One thing should be clear: you're not going to roll off the couch one morning and just run 26.2 miles. So let's read verse 24 again. "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. But I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." The ones who run to win are temperate. They exercise self-control. Running the Christian marathon requires discipline. Discipline and self-control are not natural, and they are certainly not developed overnight. If you need proof, just check out your nearest toddler. It takes time and effort to develop. Please turn to Matthew 25. And verses 1 through 10. Preparation is absolutely critical to obtaining that imperishable crown. And as Jesus Christ explained, a lack of preparation has very grave consequences. Matthew 25 and verse 1. "Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 of them were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight, a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell, and buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. All 10 virgins were in the race. 5 of them put in the time. They ran miles. 5 of them put in the 18 or even 30 weeks of training. And 5 of them were clearly novice runners, but they thought they were advanced runners. And they only did an 8-week training plan. To run this marathon, to win this marathon, you have to prepare. Point number 3. You have to play by the rules. You have to play by the rules. Please turn to 2 Timothy in verses 3 through 5. Or 2 Timothy 2. In 1980, Rosie Ruiz was initially declared the winner of the Boston Marathon, but was immediately suspected of cutting the course because of a lack of running knowledge and world-class credentials. After Ruiz was disqualified, Canadian Jacqueline Gouraud was named the winner. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3, "You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. And also, if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules." Today, if you walk up to an ancient Greek stadium, you'll pass a bunch of stone pedestals that once held great statues. But they weren't statues of champion athletes. When an athlete was caught cheating in ancient Greece, he was fined, and the money was used to put up a statue of Zeus. And the athlete's name was inscribed on the base. Anyone coming to see the games would know who the cheaters were. Turn to Matthew chapter 19 and verses 16 through 22. Now, to play by the rules, you need to know what the rules are. A couple of days before the Cleveland Marathon, runners can take bus rides that drive the path of the race. They get to see the route, and they know where all the turns are. So, what are the rules for our race? Matthew 19 and verse 16. "Now behold, one came and said to him, 'Good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?' So he said to him, 'Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments.' And he said to him, 'Which ones?' And Jesus said, 'You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." The young man said to him, "All these things I have kept from my youth. What do I still lack?" And Jesus said to him, "If you want to be perfect, go, sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me." But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. What are the rules? Jesus Christ is making an obvious reference to the Ten Commandments. Now, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but let's make sure we're all clear on this. Just because he doesn't mention commandment number 4 doesn't mean we don't have to keep the Sabbath. He doesn't mention the first 3 either, but that doesn't make it okay to worship other gods or bow down to idols. It doesn't matter how fast you run or how hard you train. If you don't keep the commandments, you can't win the prize. Point number 4. You need coaches. You need coaches. Please turn to James chapter 5 and verses 19 and 20. Now, at a marathon, the runners aren't the only crazy people who show up. Crowds of people get up early in the morning just to watch. They gather at various spots all along the route of the race. And what do they do when the runners come by? Well, if you've ever been to a race, you know. They yell, "Woohoo! Way to go! You're doing great!" And that's nice and all, but for the most part, those people have no idea how well you're doing. They yell the same thing to the guy in first as they do to the guy in 200th place. And it's not their fault, but they don't know if you're 20 minutes off the pace you're trying to run. James 5 and verse 19. "Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." We're in this race to win, and we need people who know when we're falling behind. We need people to tell us when to pick up the pace. And that's what coaches do. Turn to Proverbs 27 and verses 5 and 6. Now, earlier this year, Yuki Kawachi won the Boston Marathon, finishing the race in 2 hours, 15 minutes, and 58 seconds. And Desiree Linden was the winner of the women on the women's side with a time of 2 hours, 39 minutes, and 54 seconds. If you're running to win and you finish 5 hours behind the leader, those people who gather around the course will still tell you, "You did great." Because those people aren't coaches. They're cheerleaders. Proverbs 27 and verse 5. "Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." Now, I don't want to completely dismiss their value, and we'll get back to that. But if all you're listening to are cheerleaders, then you can feel great but they didn't help you win the prize. If you ran too slow, if you're going to win, sometimes you need a coach to tell you things that hurt. Now, hopefully, they can say it gently. But if you're 5 hours behind, your coach might have to yell at you. The wounds of a coach might sting. But if we listen, then we'll end up better off for it. Point number 5. You need to know about the wall. You need to know about the wall. Now, most of us have probably heard of hitting the wall, and the runners in the room certainly have. The notorious wall sits somewhere around mile 20. You're running the race, and then all of a sudden, everything falls apart. Your legs get heavy, breathing gets harder, and your mind turns on you, and you have an overwhelming desire to quit. Turn, please, to Jeremiah chapter 12 and verse 5. Now, the physiological cause behind hitting the wall is simple. Your body needs energy to run. Every cell in your body uses carbohydrates, a carbohydrate called glycogen, to produce that energy. Now, some cells, like the ones in your heart, are good at converting fats or even proteins into glycogen. But carbohydrates are the preferred source of fuel for all your cells. And when you run out of fuel, you stop running. You hit the wall. Now, you can try to avoid the wall with proper conditioning and by making sure you take in some carbohydrates during your run. But a research fellow at Stanford School of Medicine, Matt Buman, surveyed 315 marathoners. And 43% of them said that they had hit the wall in a recent race. So even for experienced runners, the wall is still out there. Jeremiah 12 and verse 5. If you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, then how can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace, in which you trusted, they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? We have to train, and we have to take in fuel along the way. But ignoring the wall doesn't mean it's not there. The race is going to get really hard sometimes. And if we're not ready for the wall to hit, we might not make it. Your brain cells, by the way, can't convert fats and proteins. They can only run on carbohydrates. And that's why you get the urge to quit when you hit the wall. Your brain starts shutting down to conserve energy and tells the rest of your body to do the same. Turn to 2 Corinthians 4, in verses 7 through 10. Now, marathons always start early in the morning, sometimes before 7 a.m. And they do that because it's best to run when the air is still on the cool side. Now, 6 years ago, my wife ran the Cleveland Marathon, and it was hot that day, like 80-something degrees at 9 a.m. And I'll never forget what I saw that day. At about the halfway point, I saw guys in their 20s, guys who were experienced runners, in great shape, started dropping out. And they weren't even injured. I can see the picture in my mind of one particular guy stopping and complaining, "It's too hot." He hadn't even hit the wall. Meanwhile, lots of older people and people in much worse shape, much more susceptible to the heat than him, kept running. Now, sometimes runners start a race with a goal, like finishing with a personal best time. And they reach a point where they know they're too far behind to reach that goal. But the only thing that stopped that guy from finishing that race was that he wasn't ready for it to be that hard. So he quit. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. Running 26.2 miles is really hard. It takes a special kind of crazy person to do it. They know it's a long race. They know it takes a long time to train for it. And they know that there's a very real possibility that they will hit the wall. But they do it anyway. And we're no different. We're a special kind of crazy. Point number 6. You need to remember you are not alone. You need to remember that you are not alone. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2. Now, I said I'd get back to those cheerleaders. Now, no, cheerleaders are not coaches, but that doesn't mean that they have no value. They stand around the course and they tell you, you can do it, and that gives you a boost. But on any course that stretches 26.2 miles, there are going to be spots where people can't just stand around for 4 hours, cheering runners on. Some spots are hard for spectators to get to. There are going to be spots with no shade. And on a hot, sunny day, if you're a spectator, you're not going to stand somewhere out in the sun. And it's noticeable when suddenly there's no one around cheering you on. And it can make a runner feel downright lonely. But no matter where you are on the course, we are not alone. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. We are surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Paul mentions a lot of them by name in chapter 11. We are surrounded by people who have finished their race, and they've left us their stories to tell us how to run ours. Turn to John 16, in verses 25 through 33. As you run, you are going to hit those spots in the race. You're going to notice the silence. But it's okay. You've got company. John 16 and verse 25, "These things I have spoken to you in figurative language. But the time is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figurative language. But I will tell you plainly about the Father. In that day, you will ask in my name, and I do not say to you that I shall pray the Father for you. For the Father himself loves you, because you have loved me and have believed that I came forth from God. I came forth from the Father and have come into the world. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father." His disciples said to him, "See, now you are speaking plainly and using no figure of speech. Now we are sure that you know all things and have no need that anyone should question you. By this we believe that you came forth from God." And Jesus answered them, "Do you now believe? Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." Jesus Christ knew that he was going to hit those spots where nobody would be around to cheer him on. He would hear no words of encouragement, but he ran the race, and he won it. And just like our brother, even at our darkest hour, we are not alone. Let's read Isaiah chapter 40 and verses 27 through 41. Is this race going to be tough? Yep. Is it going to feel lonely sometimes? Yep. We're not running alone. Isaiah 40 and verse 27. "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength." Verse 30, "Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. they shall walk and not faint. No matter how quiet it is or how hard it is, you are never alone. Point number 7, never quit. Never quit. Please turn to Philippians 3, verses 12 through 14. In a marathon, there are big flags set up to mark every mile of the course. The number on that flag tells you how many miles you've run already. And it reminds you how many miles you still have to go. Philippians 3 and verse 12. Not that I have already attained or am already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ Jesus has also laid hold of me. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. When you see that flag, with that big number 20 on it, it might hit you that even after you've run all those miles, you still have 6 more miles to go. And you may smack right into the wall, but you can't quit. You have to keep going. Turn to 2 Corinthians 4 again. And this time, we'll read verses 16 through 18. The crowds might be gone. There are no cheerleaders, and your coaches may not be there to push you. But none of that matters, because you are running for the prize. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. You can't see the finish line because there are still too many turns in the course. Your legs may be killing you, but you don't quit. You never quit. Turn finally to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 6 through 8. This is a description from Boston.com of the last section of the course in the Boston Marathon. Heartbreak Hill. The final hill, the legendary Heartbreak, begins after the shops at Center Street and rises a half mile to Hammond Street. In itself, the incline is merely challenging, but after 20 and a half miles, the effort becomes the toughest stretch on the course. Once at the summit, however, the Prudential Tower comes into view. The BC band may be playing, and a half mile of downhill lies ahead to ease your breathing and punish your legs. 23 miles, Brookline. After leaving Cleveland Circle, Beacon Street brings unbroken crowds, an unbroken struggle. The emotional surge of cresting Heartbreak has given way to the realization that your reserves are almost empty. Your legs are deadened, and between you and the finish lies a seemingly endless succession of nasty little hills. By this point, at Washington Street, finishing has become an obsession. The end is near, but each step is an effort. 25.2 miles, Kenmore Square. With a mile left, the final drive is a hazy mix of sound, exhaustion, pain, and lost coordination. The mind may try to calculate distance, pace, and finishing time, but the effort is often futile. The numbers jumble together. A glance to the side, and there's the Elliott Lounge at Massachusetts Avenue. One more block, and turn right on Hereford Street, where the crowd seems as large as the Fenway bleachers on a Sunday afternoon. Strain up a small rise and wheel onto Boylston Street, where nothing is left, but everything is summoned. The finish, finally the end, and a staggering two-block walk to the family receiving area. Sitting on the sidewalk, back to the Hancock Tower, the body slowly regains a bit of strength. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 6. I think it's 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 6. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearance.